Hi, I'm Tim Gerson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Gersonese Podcast, episode 183. Grierson, a little scheduling note, by the way, before people get excited. You've got some film festivals to go to coming up. You're going to Toronto, and then you're going to Boise. Where are you going after Toronto?
No, you're reverse. I'm going to Venice, and then I'm going to
Venice.
Toronto.
Right. Oh, Venice,
then and then
Toronto.
Maybe Boise afterwards. Yeah, I'm very excited. I've gone to Toronto for about 10 years now, but this is my first year going to the Venice Film Festival. I'm very excited about that.
I'm very excited the fact that you have to swim to every film. That to me, I like the idea that let's start getting those film critics a little bit more physically active.
Right. I'm trying to imagine the scenario if that was true. But no, you know, but I don't think we've talked about this, have we, Will? You do ride bikes from your place to the festival. You rent a bike. It's very like civilized. You rent a bike and you bike back and forth. So if you
very
want to imagine,
Darden's brother, seems like the type of thing I would see in like everyone's just so charming and riding their bike.
I did ask the question about how you keep the bikes from being stolen. Speaking of Italian classics, but I was like, how does that work? But if you want to imagine hundreds upon hundreds of film critics riding bikes to and from Venice Film Festival, that's the place to go.
Well, I think you should all swim. The whole thing turns into crawl. they have alligators. Probably don't have alligators.
Well, my understanding is that because the city is sinking, that there is like water on the ground apparently. So it's not that far to imagine that. But yes.
Probably fewer gators. It just seems like there's
yes.
Fewer gators.
I won't even wear my water wings. Put it that way.
I want to ask you very briefly before we get going. Big news on this week, The Hunt, a movie from Universal Pictures starring Hilary Swank and directed by Craig, what's his name? Craig Zabel? Craig Zabel?
Zobel.
Zobel, that's it. Zobel. The guy that did the movie you liked a lot.
He did Compliance.
Compliance. You like that movie a lot more than me. Yes. But you like the movie a lot. His movie, but certainly I find him an interesting director. I'm not crazy about Compliance, but I think he's an interesting guy, and I certainly suspect he'd bring something to the movie. His movie, The Hunt, was canceled, like flat out bonked, canceled by Universal because of, I always assume it's Gamergate, right? Like it's always just Gamergate bullshit every single time. Because apparently what I'm assuming is a somewhat satirical, at least cleverly done premise of liberal elites attacking real American dudes and ladies. I suspect the problem, Grierson, is that people that run our country are, I think one of the nicest things I've ever said about them is that they are irony deficient. And I feel like it's another sign. I think it was a Scott Tobias or was it Keith Phipps? You know how I'm always confusing the two of those great guys. I thought only North Korea canceled.
That was Keith. Yeah, that was Keith. Yeah, it's pretty exciting to think that Universal had to pull the movie because they thought, well, at this point, what are the odds that someone's going to come in with a gun to a theater? And we don't want that liability. I mean, that is, I don't think, an exaggeration of part of the calculus of the decision not to release the movie. I forget who wrote the tweet this weekend that, like, it's really exciting that our president just can, like, assemble a group of mass murderers to do his bidding when he's unhappy about stuff. I spent most of Saturday having to get writing done and really having to struggle because it just seemed like it's fun to have like my profession and the art form I love basically be treated like complete shit by the president. And then the studios have to say, well, we should probably do something because we can't trust the leader of our country to be responsible. So we'll have to take this matter into our own hands and extricate ourselves from the situation. So, yeah, I mean, no one's seen the movie, so no one knows if it's good, bad, or otherwise. But it's really, really depressing.
Yep. Yep. Fun week, Grierson. Really has been a fun week.
That's why I'm swimming to Venice. Get me the fuck out of here.
I'm wondering if Grierson is even going to swim back. This is Gersonese Podcast, episode 183. Remind you to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Email us, griersonleach@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook? That's one of them. Instagram, Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. I don't spell it anymore. I generally assume that everybody knows how to spell it by now. Go to our website, griersonleach.com, griersonleach.com/RSVP. You see the list of every single movie we've talked about on this here podcast, I sang Greatest. My friend Burtis Downs here in Athens has a yearly fundraiser for his birthday for the Athens Anti-Discrimination Committee. I forgot what the last word is, but they're helping people fight discrimination here in Athens, Georgia. And they're not for it.
They're against it.
They're very anti. It's not A. It's not AFA. It's not AFD. It's AAD. Whatever the last line is. Anyway, the point is he does a yearly thing where he has a bunch of friends go like sing with a live band. Last year it was U2, and I did The Fly. This year it was Tom Petty. I did I Need to Know. But the thing is because he's Burtis Downs, for those of you who don't know, Burtis Downs is the manager of REM, and he has the center of that whole kind of music scene. So he knows all these incredible singers that all come and sing for him. And then because I am friends with him, he asked me to go as well. And Grierson knows, because he beat me out for the part of Nathan Detroit in Guys and Dolls in 1993, I can't sing.
That's a weird way of describing what happened 25 years ago, but yeah, it came down to you or me. That's definitely my memory as well, as how
because you and I were the two most charismatic people, but you could sing and I couldn't. But that did not stop
me. That was exactly what happened. Actually, the real fun story is, what song did I sing for my audition for Guys?
I know this. I know this.
All these years ago. Will, speaking of, you're the only human being would know. What song did I sing?
I believe you sang Night Swimming.
That is correct. I did.
Yes. All right. Good man. Good man.
Tell your friend Burtis that.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so my voice is kind of gone because I can't sing, so I just screamed really loud. It's amazing to me what musicians do, because I Need to Know is like 2 minutes long. It's an incredibly short song with like just a repeated chorus over and over and like two verses, and still my voice is almost completely gone after doing that for 2 minutes on a Friday night.
I don't understand why you did not choose the interlude between sides on Full Moon Fever. You don't have to sing that. It's just spoken. It's pretty short. You could have just done that. Yeah.
I was going to do Peace in L.A., but I think Tom Petty had that eliminated from all of Spotify, so no one could learn that song.
Yeah. Hey, don't be a fool. Be cool.
Be cool. Yeah. Anyway, go to grizzlies.com/RSVP.
Yes.
Find a list of every movie we talked about on the podcast. We have a T-shirt, Grierson. Where can people get a T-shirt?
I have to recover from that 90s nostalgia blast. Hold on a second. You can get that for cottonbureau.com.
Yeah, cottonbureau.com. It's a good thing it's not 90s because people are like, .com, what? The opening song is from Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue, Van Camp and Santa Claus, where you find it. Closing song is My Friend Mary. The album is Short Songs and Melancholy Long. His Facebook page, My Friend Mary. Subscribe to us, Grierson. Subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to find every podcast, the second it goes up, to subscribe to us on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. And if you do, and you leave us the name of a movie you would like us to discuss, we will discuss it in our reboot section. We have one reboot this week, Grierson. It comes to us from the GDR. This is from 2 years ago, 2017. So post-apocalypse, but pre-apocalypse. Require listening for any film fan, writes the GDR. I was lucky enough to stumble upon the reviews of Tim Grierson and Will Leach and start listening to the podcast. They're terrific. I'm a fan of Siskel and Ebert and Double Toasted, another great two-critic podcast worth your time. Do you know that podcast, Grierson? I have to confess, I don't know it.
I confess I do not know it either.
But they seem like great guys. If they're compared to us, they're probably better. But Grierson and Leach are easily the top of their game. Oh, thanks, GDR. Why? The GDR asks. The podcast is accessible but not pandering. They don't shirk on art house movies, as Double Toasted sometimes does. They totally do.
I love this is becoming an attack ad on a thing we're not even aware of.
Podcast I've never heard of and are probably perfectly nice people. Yep. Or condescend to well-crafted popcorn movies. New York critic Anthony Lane, I'm looking at you. Look out, Anthony Lane. This dude's staring at you. Or at least he was 2 years ago.
The call is coming from inside the house.
If you consider yourself a film buff, you owe it to yourself to subscribe. For a reboot, I'd like their opinion on the love it or hate it Beyond the Black Rainbow. So we'll be discussing Panos Cosmatos, I think is his name. We'll see. The guy that did Mandy, if you like that weird Nicolas Cage movie from last year. But first, Grierson, we have a new movie, two movies to discuss, as a matter of fact. And the first new movie is The Kitchen.
Times change. You do what you gotta do. From kids.
Most employers don't want mothers. It's a competitive market.
You don't know me.
For money, you survive.
Now might be the time.
For what?
For you.
The Kitchen is written and directed by Andrea Berloff, who wrote World Trade Center and Straight Outta Compton and Sleepless and Bloodfather, but this is her directorial debut. It's apparently based off a DC comic series. I confess I've not heard of it, but I don't know a lot of DC comic stuff. I think the Green Lantern is actually the only one that I know. This stars Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Elizabeth Moss as, respectively, Kathy, Ruby, and Claire. They are the wives of, I would say, mid to lower tier members of the Irish mob in Hell's Kitchen in New York City in the mid-70s. That's about right, right?
Like late 70s, 1978, yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. The age of Star Wars and Annie Hall.
That's what's informing the action. Lots of Annie Hall references in this movie.
Yes. Basically what happens at the beginning of the film, their husbands are all arrested and taken off to jail. Then they realize they are short on money. The leader of the Irish mob is not taking care of them, not giving them enough money to live by. So they decide, you know, we don't think these guys are doing a very good job. We're smarter than they are. We're going to go ahead and just take over the Irish mob. And so they do. Now, their circumstances are a little bit different. Kathy, who's played by Melissa McCarthy, is actually very happily married and dedicated to her husband and her family. But she's always been very smart, probably smarter than her husband, and has a lot of skills that have been underutilized. Tiffany Haddish is an African-American woman married to a member of the Irish mob and has therefore been kind of lambasted and ostracized anyway by a lot of people in the mob, including by the matriarch of the family, played by disappointingly not good Margot Martindale. If you ever wondered, is it possible for Margot Martindale not to be good in something? I'm the bearer of bad tidings to tell you this. We finally found it. She is not good in this movie, and I did not think that was even possible. And the third is Elizabeth Moss as Claire. Claire is heavily beaten by her husband and is kind of taken down. She feels like she's always kind of stomped upon. She's very abused, and in a lot of ways, of the one perhaps most directly set up to benefit by having the husbands gone. The Kitchen is confused, would be a good way to put it. One of the things that's really weird about this movie is it tries to do two things. It tries to, like, you know, tell, to kind of like flip the old gangster movie style movie on their head by now there are women in charge, and the movie still partly goes through the motions of kind of what you've seen in every kind of mobster gangster movie, where things are starting great and then in the middle they peak and then things start to go downhill and then things like get out of control because it turns out Grierson, crime does not pay.
Does not.
Uh-huh. I didn't use a contraction. I was very clear on that. Does okay. not. Okay. On the other hand, it is wants to be almost a woman empowerment movie. One of the subplots. One of the few interesting things about the movie is there is a lot to be said in the idea that, like, things get better, that everything runs more efficiently. The women that are running the mob here are doing a better job than the men do, and they're more efficient than they do. One of the reasons that they're good at what they do is because all the things that the mob is supposed to provide, protection and some sort of clarity and some sort of organization, the men have kind of let that pass, have gotten very lazy about it, and so they actually kind of tighten it up. So I think that's semi-kind of interesting. Another thing that's kind of interesting is Elizabeth Moss's character, Claire. She goes from being this beaten woman to, how long did it take you to realize that's Domhnall Gleeson, by the way, Grierson? Domhnall Gleeson, right after seeing About Time, basically this enforcer who's been away on the West Coast, part of the family, but has been away from the West Coast, comes back, he's played by Domhnall Gleeson, of all people, and he's like a dead-eyed psychopath. Played by Domhnall Gleeson, I would argue pretty well, actually. And the two of them kind of start to find romance through sociopathy in a way that in a better movie, I think, would have been kind of an interesting turn. But unfortunately, this is actually not that good of a movie. The movie feels disjointed in a... I feel like there were some hands in the, forgive the pun here, but there were some hands in the kitchen when they were making this movie. I don't know what happened. I don't know if Perloff, they didn't like some of the other things that she was showing them, but the movie is very disjointed. It feels a little lumpy, I think was the word I used last time. The actresses feel like they're kind of in a comedy and kind of not in a comedy, and never really picks which way it wants to go. It's also strange that there's like this woman empowerment movement movie, but like it's the movie just kind of wants to take it at that. Like there's a scene in this movie where they gun down a pimp on the streets, and because they're trying to take over his territory, and the movie tries to sell us as like, yeah, you go, girl. It's like, they just murdered somebody. I feel like maybe that's not, I'm not trying to be like, you know, the man keeping the woman down here, but I kind of feel like murdering people in the street is maybe not. And maybe, listen, if the movie like amped that up and like played with that idea and was like cheerfully amoral, I think there might've been something to it. But the movie's too kind of confused and muddled to kind of pick a direction one way or the other. It's when you think of the opportunity, I mean, these are three really fun actresses, and just the idea of them being bad ass and taking over a mob in a way that the men can't. It sounds like a good idea, and it feels like there are some ingredients there, but this thing really doesn't work at all, I'm afraid.
I liked it a little bit better than you, but I would not recommend it. I think the stuff that you talked about that is interesting, I found more interesting, I guess, is sort of my thumbnail. You didn't even mention Bill Camp, first of all.
I'm saving Bill Camp for you.
Bill Camp, I think, is actually good in this. I do like Bill Camp in this.
He is great in this.
So my Bill Camp fan club continues apace. I think he's actually pretty fun. I have been informed by all my female friends that Domhnall Gleeson has never been hotter than he is in this movie. I have different people, just completely separate from each other, go, how hot is he in that movie? And I'm like, you know, he's a good-looking dude. And I'm like, no, he has never been hotter in a movie before. So I asked them, and the beard apparently works for him, and also the messier hair works really well.
And the dead eyes. The dead eyes got to be something.
I actually do think he's good. I actually like him in this. Of the lead actresses, I think two of the three of them are good. I actually think Melissa McCarthy's really good in this. I actually like her. We updated our Melissa McCarthy rankings for Vulture, and I had her relatively high up because I actually think this is an encouraging development for her as an actress, because, you know, I think we still think of her as one of two types on screen, either sort of the broad performances and like Identity Theft, Thief, whatever that movie was called, or the more serious stuff like Can You Ever Forgive Me, either comedy or drama. The thing I actually like about her in this is that she plays, this is more kind of like a movie star role in a way, where she is not as extreme as her two co-stars in terms of what they do. But I think that she actually delivers the best moments in this movie, which is near the end, so I won't spoil it. But she has to tell somebody near the end of the movie why she does something, and it's a little on the nose. This is the theme of this movie. But I actually think she delivers it really compellingly, and I think it actually works really well. I also think Elizabeth Moss is really good in this. She is in some ways the most stereotypical character in that, she's really, like you said, she's abused. She doesn't have any sort of self-respect for herself. The movie is about her finding her confidence in a really weird way, because she discovers that she's good at dismembering bodies. And that, I think, is actually kind of fun in terms of how that character plays it. Tiffany Haddish, I think she is fine. I think part of the problem is that character makes less sense as the film goes along. And Tiffany Haddish, I don't think, is strong enough as an actress yet to pull off what is kind of a ridiculous character change in the film. And I would say in general that the thing I did kind of dig in the movie is something that you brought up, Will. I actually think it is interesting that the movie is a female empowerment. It feels very much a Me Too, Time's Up kind of metaphor. And yet the movie says, but you know what? These women kill people or have people kill people for them, and that's okay. And the thing I actually kind of liked about that is I was thinking about a lot of, you know, male mobster gangster movies like Goodfellas or whatever. Those guys kill a ton of people. But those movies kind of want to have it both ways too. They want it to be, you know, we are supposed to in some way or another at least connect to them, or at least be interested by, wow, it's so interesting how dark and morally ambiguous, or the ambiguity that they have in terms of, are they killers? Are they good people underneath that? Or are they wrestling with their demons? And that's supposed to be compelling in a movie like Goodfellas. I had in some ways the same reaction that you did to The Kitchen, which is like, wait, if they're supposed to be like empowered, why are they killing people? And then I thought to myself, I wouldn't think about this if it was a movie with men. And I think that that is interesting in the movie. And I think that the movie does not do a good enough job of executing that tension with the characters. But I think it's interesting. And I do feel like in some ways, I reviewed this movie for Screen International, and the thing I actually wrote is that I feel like in some ways this movie is going to be a better time capsule of an era, of saying this is the type of movie that came out in the wake of Me Too and Time's Up in terms of female characters who have been held under the thumb of the men around them and finally wanting to have sort of their own voice and their own independence. I just don't think it works as a movie. But I think like historians will look back at this period and look at a movie like this and be like, oh, this is really interesting because it definitely spoke to what was going on at the time. Unfortunately, we're not grading a movie on its historical value. We're actually talking its entertainment value. And on that level, I agree. The movie doesn't work, especially in the first half an hour. It's edited weird, which is my which is my professional critic way of describing that there are cuts in this thing that feel like things have been chopped up. It feels like something has happened to this movie. I have no insider knowledge of that, but it feels that way. It feels disjointed. And as it starts to put it this way, I still don't understand the reasoning behind, well, we should just have some scenes of, you know, the three main characters dancing at a club.
Yes.
And it feels like something that was shot and then just thrown in because they had it. It is a movie that does not project confidence, I guess is the best way to say it. And because it doesn't project confidence, when things start to make less and less sense in terms of what the characters do or the way the plot goes, I do not give the movie the benefit of the doubt because I don't think they know exactly what they are doing. So I don't think it's quite the disaster that I know that a lot of folks do. It still does not work. It's still not a successful movie.
Yeah, the first half hour, 45 minutes is rough, and it's weird. There's a lot of even like unnecessary scenes. The whole Margot Martindale thing seems very confused, right? Like the first time we see her, she appears to be in charge of everything, and then all of a sudden she's a feeble woman asking for money, and it was a very the Margot Martindale character feels like maybe an earlier version. I mean, that makes sense. Like the idea of Margot Martindale as the head of a crime family and then these three other women having to get through men to get through her sounds fascinating. Like that sounds like a good idea, but man, it doesn't work. And then where her story ultimately goes is just like, oh, right, she's in the movie. We should stop that. Like it really just like they just kind of like discard her in a way that's pretty disappointing. And so I think that's the thing. You talk about confidence. So many things are set up for them here real well. And if you can screw up the Margot Martindale, I think McCarthy's fine. I think Moss is the best one. I think that there is a certain kind of joy that she gets, almost an embarrassed joy that she gets when she realizes, oh, I like killing people and cutting their bodies apart. That's something I've just learned about myself. That is, I think, has a lot of fun and contrasts very well with Gleason's kind of, like I said, dead eye hotness, apparently. So I think that works. And I kind of wish the whole movie, when it takes that turn and when Bill Camp shows up, it's a lot better. I also like the way that Bill Camp character, he's the head of the Brooklyn mob. I kind of like the respect he has for the women. I actually think that's really interesting. And I think, again, another direction the movie should have gone. But so much of it, like, even for the first half hour, 45 minutes, it's just like, wait, so these women apparently just travel together in like a Greek chorus everywhere to witness all the big narrative scenes going on in the movie. Like, it's weird, like, are they friends? It's never established that they're friends or that they even know each other. And at the time, like, oh, is this like Stupid Widows? Is this like the stupid version of Widows? And I know you like Widows more than me, but like, certainly it felt like for the first half hour, it doesn't feel like the movie has any idea where it's going at all. And so that makes it that much frustrating. As you said, it makes you not trust what's going on later. There is still good stuff. I wouldn't say this is a disaster, but I think it's definitely a missed opportunity.
I think also to the Margot Martindale point, I don't mind her as much in this movie, but I think it speaks to a larger problem, which is that it's not just tone. It's just kind of like feel that's a little off, because I would argue that Melissa McCarthy, really all three of the lead actresses, are pretty much naturalistic, realistic. As you know, the accents are a little, you know, kind of iffy, but they're supposed to be kind of naturalistic. Margot Martindale feels much more cartoony, and there are other elements of the movie that feel much more like we're not making a, you know, late 1970s crime drama. We're doing like the cartoon version of it. And again, that's fine to do that. But when the stakes keep rising, I think they rise. When the stakes keep rising and you also simultaneously have cartoony characters in that, that's a weird disconnect. And it's like, wait, am I taking this seriously or am I not taking this seriously? The problem with like Margot Martindale, this is a far exaggeration, but she's almost like from the Dick Tracy movie version. She's supposed to be like, she's got like comically big glasses and comically big hair. And she feels like a mobster cliche, where I think that Bill Camp actually is more believable and more kind of naturalistic in terms of how they play him. And he becomes more important as the film goes along. And so that actually works because he's more sort of believable. Yeah, we've gone this whole way without mentioning Widows. I was, as a big fan of Widows, I wasn't necessarily expecting this to be better, different, whatever. I just thought, okay, somewhat similar story. I know that this movie has not done very well at the box office, which is not make me happy per se, but I'm actually glad that it's not a runaway blockbuster where it's like, it would make me even angrier at Fox for kind of blowing Widows, frankly, because like, look, you had the material. These people made an inferior product and made that movie a hit. You could have done the same with Widows. Yeah, it's a mess. It doesn't work. And for 100 minutes or so, it feels a lot longer than that. But if they had just cut one of the many scenes of the women walking triumphantly in slow motion, that yeah, might have. And that's right the thing. And that's the thing I'm frustrated by. Because I think in a better movie, you go, "Oh, that's awesome!" Like, because these women are kicking ass, like you said. But because the movie isn't good enough, it feels pandering and it feels cheap in a way where it's like you haven't earned the awesome slow motion walking moment.
All right. So, what did you give it?
I give it a C+.
Yeah, I give it a C, so we're not too far off. We're not too far off. I think that, but yeah, there are bits and pieces in here that I think that are interesting, and just make the whole plan out of Elizabeth Moss, Domhnall Gleeson, and Bill Camp. I think you're going to be fine. All right, now we go to our second and final new movie of the week. That movie is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Some people believe if we repeat stories often enough, they become real. They make us who we are. That can be scary.
Eat it, Harold.
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is based on a series of kids, young adult horror books from our childhood, which I did not read. Will, did you read these books?
I had literally never heard of it. I had not either.
I was completely, yeah. But they were written by Alvin Schwartz. It was directed by Andre Avridal, who probably most famously did Trollhunter. He's done some stuff since then, but it's still the thing he's best known for. But in some ways, this movie also very much has the hand of its producer and story by person, Guillermo del Toro. It is set in the past, like The Kitchen is. This is set in 1968, though, in the small town of Mill Valley, Pennsylvania. And it stars Zoe Coletti, who cards on the table, I think, is absolutely tremendous in this movie. She plays Stella, who is a young person living in a small town. It's around Halloween. And she and a group of her friends end up, as one tends to do in horror movies like this, in an old abandoned house that may or may not be haunted. They break into the house and they do the thing that people in horror movies like this tend to do. They see a book. They probably should not take the book because stealing is wrong, but they take the book. And what they discover is that the book has a collection of what looks like written in blood, short, pithy horror stories. And those stories are actually being written on the page as they turn the pages. And even more disturbing, the stories that are being written out in real life are corresponding to actual people that they know. The horrific events then actually happen to their friends. The question is, who is doing this and how can they stop it? I haven't read the books. My understanding of it is this, that what is happening in the movie is sort of a greatest hits, a compendium of different stories from Alvin Schwartz. I keep wanting to say Alvin Sargent, but that was the screenwriter. Alvin Schwartz's different scary tales. The movie combines them through the conceit of this book that has all of these stories in it. So if you are familiar with different like kind of classic stories in this collection, they are things that happen in the movie. They are different little sequences. I was pleasantly surprised enough by Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. I don't think it's great, but the thing I really appreciate about it, in comparison to a movie we are not going to talk about this week, which is Dory and the Lost City of Gold, a very different movie. But the thing I actually appreciate about Scary Stories is that I think it is geared towards younger viewers, but does not talk down to them. The joke I've been making this week is this is kind of like Tonka, my first horror movie. Like, it plays like a horror movie for young people who maybe have never seen a horror movie. And it kind of inoculates them or indoctrinates them into the idea of what a horror movie is. This is not gory. It's not really bloody. But it's creepy and it's icky. And to go back to Guillermo del Toro, it has the thing that I like in his movies where it's got really evocative monsters, which may not like do a bunch of gore, but they kind of get under your skin, in one case literally in one of the stories, and they freak you out. And I think that's what this movie does pretty darn well. It's one of two things it does really darn well, is that I actually think the stories themselves play out really nicely, because in general I am not a fan of these terrible things keep happening. How can we stop it? Because I keep thinking, how many sequences do I have to get through to find out how they're going to stop it? And this movie also has that problem. But I actually think that they actually build, and the actual set pieces get better as they go along. I think there are three really good set pieces that conclude this movie that all work really well. So that's one element. The other element is a small thing, but I actually think it matters. Without being overly woke about it, or however you want to put it, I think the movie actually is kind of about something. I think the movie is about, without spoiling anything, I think it's about believing women. And I think that actually works really well in the film. I mentioned Zoe Coletti, who I think is really great in this as Stella. She plays a kind of an outcast nerd. You can tell this because in a movie, she is an attractive girl who wears glasses. And I think that what Zoe Clay does really well is she creates the sense of a young person, a young woman who doesn't feel very confident about herself, but will get more confident, weirdly, as she kind of goes through the telling of the story. What is happening, we discover, is that in this whole thing may be connected to a young woman from years and years and years ago who is now getting revenge on the world for something that happened to her. That is not a new conceit in a horror movie, but I actually think this movie has an interesting sort of sensitivity in terms of how it tells that story and how it reveals it that works really, really nicely. Now, there are a lot of problems with this film. This is the type of film where people do stupid things to allow the plot to go forward or for the horror stuff to happen. A lot of the supporting characters are way too broad for my taste. Don't worry, they'll get killed off soon enough. But I have to say, just in general, I was very pleasantly surprised by this thing. I think it works.
I think I'm not as high as you are. I like it, but barely. You got to get through a lot to get to the good stuff. Those supporting characters are, I mean, the movie starts like kind of in an exciting fashion. There's like this cool like setup to Season of the Witch that's like, I'm like, okay, I'm with this movie right now. And it definitely feels like, okay, this is a smart movie that's gonna do what I want it to. And then it just kind of stops for a while as this shithead guy shows up and this dopey friendly character's up and here's another jerk. And it feels, there's a slog of about 20, 25 minutes of third tier Stephen King it characters, the bad guys. What are the name of the jerks and the gang that's always running around causing trouble? And that they feel like they're street toughs, Grierson.
They're 19 late 1960s street toughs, no question.
Yeah, and they're very tiresome. And I'm like, and again, on one end, yes, oh good. Well, I get to wait. I'm gonna bet these guys get killed eventually, but it's a slog, and it made me lose a little confidence. In the movie, she's really good and she kind of keeps you going. But I mean, really, this movie is about the set pieces, right? It's about, I mean, the movie's called Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. And apparently other people have read all of these books. So people are there to want to see the stories. And I do think, I'm curious, which is your favorite one? Like, which did you find the most evocative one of those stories?
I forget the name of the horror character. But it's the hospital.
Yeah.
Really, really, really effectively done. It's really well done, I think. Yeah,
and that's the thing is, you know, I will be careful, but I think it does. The movie sets up a potential sequel. It seems to have done well this weekend. I feel like once we can get the other stuff out of the way, of they have to all get in this house and they have to find the book and they have to like the wind up for this is exhausting. It goes on too long. The movie is actually a little bit too long on its own. And it's funny, what I actually thought this was when I came in to see it is what I kind of wish it was. I wish it was just an anthology, right? Like I wish, like the Tales from the Crypt, Tonka, your first Tales from the Crypt kind of idea. And that would deny me her, and I think that she's really good. I would be okay with it denying me the other people, though. I really didn't find any other. I find them mostly kind of bland. And I'm with you on the overarching theme, and I think there is something to it. And ultimately, that and the effectiveness of the scares are what ultimately gets me to liking the movie. But there is, like, there's a lot of long-winded buildup to get there. Part of me wishes we could have just found a way to, like, dramatize the stories on their own and then maybe find a loose thread that ties them all together. There's a lot of wind-up for the payoff ultimately being like, well, at least we get to see these guys die, but it takes a while to get there.
Yeah, I agree. I think I have undersold how mixed the first hour of this movie is, because there is a lot of the characters around Stella are just not as interesting. Though I do think Michael Garza as Ramon is also really good, and that is a nice emotional moment that happens at the end. I won't reveal what it is, of course. But I think that's actually a really nicely done thing where it's almost, it's so subtle in a certain way that I was like, oh, gosh, that's a really nice little beat for that character at the end. But it is the sort of movie where you go, okay, who are the characters that they care about to make them interesting? Because they're the ones who are probably going to make it to the end. Everybody else is dead meat. And your guess is completely right in terms of which ones are the ones who are going to get it early. And I also found some of the, as there is a lot of setup. And also I just, in general with horror movies, when you have to go to the archives, I always just go, oh, here we go. When microfiche is pulled out, it is amazing where I'm like, okay, I know for my professional obligation, I have to pay attention to this because this will be important because it is so, you know, we talked about David Fincher's Girl with a Dragon Tattoo years ago for the reboot. But my God, the way that movie synthesizes information, it's just like amazing, and everything else is just, it really is like, okay, everybody pay attention, here's the plot thing you need to know, like, you know, scrolling through microfiche, blah blah blah, you know. And the headlines always make me laugh just because it's like, this is not how headlines work, right. But they're helpful in the movie, you know, to tell you what you need to know. That stuff is pretty sort of kind of basic. But I also just, I just sort of respected the fact, and I think that's partly Del Toro's doing also, but I just respected the fact that the movie didn't talk down to its audience. I did not watch this movie thinking, oh, this movie is not for me because I'm older than the target audience. But at the same time, I felt that it was maybe communicating to younger people in terms of certain anxieties they have and things like that. Yeah, it is good enough for me to like. I want to be very careful. I don't want to kind of oversell the thing. I, like you, Will, I actually thought this was going to be an anthology film. And so I was sort of surprised, like, oh, I guess that's not what's happening here. When the ending comes and you realize that perhaps this is a setup for a sequel, my heart did kind of sink a little bit. I'm like, like, listen, you lucked out here. Let's not push it. But and the thing I especially like about Zoe Coletti is it's such a hard thing to quantify and also I think to perform. But when she's scared in the second half of this movie, I really feel it. And when she is upset in the second half of the movie, I really feel it. There's a whole, I don't want to ruin it, but there's like a whole sequence at the end of this that involves cross-cutting, let's say. I think it's really, really upsetting. I actually felt it in a way where it's not, I wouldn't say I was scared a ton while watching this movie, but I felt for her. I was concerned about her well-being and also Ramon's to a certain extent as well. I was invested in what happens to them. And so this movie is not like whatever scary movie you want to compare it to. I don't think it's as scary, but I think it's effective. I think it works really nicely.
All right, so what'd you give it?
So after all of that, I landed on a B-minus for this.
B-minus. Yeah, I landed on a, where's the bell of agreement? B-minus as well for me, Grierson. So I think you're a higher B-minus than I am. But at this point, does that matter?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm probably overpraising it, and I'll acknowledge that. But I think that this movie is smarter and is more emotionally going on than one might expect from a mid-August horror movie. It's actually better than I expected, but I do not need a sequel for this.
Well, you're going to get one. All right, now we go to our reboot. Our reboot for the week is Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Hello. My name is Dr. Mercurio Arborea, and I am the founder of the Arborea Institute. Through our unique blend of benign pharmacology, sensory therapy, and energy sculpting, we can guide you to a new, better, happier you.
Beyond the Black Rainbow is written and directed by Panos Cosmatos, who, as I mentioned earlier, did Mandy, the wild-ass Nicolas Cage. Did you read the Nicolas Cage piece in the New York Times Magazine, by the way, Grierson?
I haven't gone all the way through it yet, but I've been enjoying it.
It's fun.
David Marchese, I think he's just. I am in complete awe of him, and yeah, I think he's great.
And it's fun. It's fun the right way too, because it's not just let's see the crazy stuff Nicolas Cage says. Yes. Like it's just good. Yeah, it's good. So while still acknowledging that sometimes Nicolas Cage says some crazy shit. Anyway, Beyond the Black Rainbow does not have Nicolas Cage, though in spirit it does. It stars basically the best way to describe it is it stars Michael Rogers. A guy who turns out is creepy both with and without hair.
And, congratulations, Michael Rogers.
Yes. I take pride in being that type of person myself. I've not seen myself without hair, but I bet I'm creepy. He plays, this is the type of movie that's kind of weird to do a large plot description about, but he plays Barry Nile. He's the movie starts where we learn about the Arborea Institute, which seems to be kind of a self-help sort of resort or getaway place. But as it turns out, there's some sort of other sinister stuff going on. A lot of that's because of Barry. He's like the protege of like the guy that started, who Barry goes in back like years before. This movie takes place in the 80s, about 15 years earlier. He has some sort of psychic experience that is portrayed in, like everything else in this movie, in vivid images. Where, that so he, and so he therefore takes the daughter, I believe. This is a movie where you have to like kind of piece the plot together.
That was a Wikipedia news item to me, by the way.
Yes,
his daughter?
Yes.
Sure.
But apparently there's a woman who has strong psychic abilities that he tries to keep away from society, but she ends up becoming more and more powerful. And yeah, I just feel like I'm
that's fine. That's
attaching
enough.
Details. Yeah, I'm attaching
enough.
Details to a story.
That's good.
Whether or not if you've seen Mandy, and I recommend you see Mandy, we both like Mandy. A movie I think is actually better than this. If you see Mandy, you get a kind of glimpse of kind of what we're talking about. This is a guy that is obsessed with those kind of like creepy imagery with like 80s death metal, but not like Megadeth death metal, more like the crazy, you know, the crazy off Pink Floyd, like metal with like a little Pink Floyd in it. Would that be a fair?
If you imagine Norse gods playing the biggest guitars with the biggest Marshall amps behind them, that's the kind of sound. Yeah.
Maybe non-ironic guar. Think of it that way. It's not got that kind of vibe to it. The story, I think, is very... the story, again, it's like you have to kind of have to piece together the story. I don't think that really what matters. What matters is whether you can kind of dig on the vibes of kind of the images and the mood. This has seriously have a little less of a budget than Mandy did. But I think he does a good job of kind of creating an evocative world within that budget. It has a pretty strong lead performance by the guy that plays Barry, and I would argue better than the lead performance of the bad guy in Mandy, who's basically just the ADA cutter from Law and Order showing his penis for like a 20-minute scene, and he's like a little less creepy. This guy, I would actually love to see this guy play him, because this guy's legit like scary, creepy in like every possible way, whereas I feel like he was kind of play creepy in Mandy. The movie eventually has some of the violence that you kind of see in Mandy. I felt like this was almost a good dry run for Mandy, and that Mandy has like I think more solid set pieces, goes in a crazier way, has more kind of narrative thrust, and ends up in a place that is pretty satisfying. This feels like a guy who can do that, make this kind of imagery and make this kind of crazy environment and give you that kind of midnight movie feel, but doesn't have anything else to add to it. I feel like Mandy is the better version of this movie. I'm glad I saw Mandy first, because if I would have seen this, I'd have been like, I don't think I want to see Mandy. But now that I've seen Mandy, it made me appreciate this a little bit.
I think the challenge with a movie like this, and also with Mandy, is, you know, it establishes like a tone and a mood, and you think, oh, this tone and mood and feel is really hypnotic. Can they keep it going? And I have to say that in general, when I ask that question in the first 20 minutes, the answer tends to be no. I have to say, I kind of love this. I really, really loved it. I actually like it better than Mandy, and you actually hit on one of the reasons why I like it better than Mandy. I think this movie doesn't run out of story, which is a weird thing to say because this has a lot less story than Mandy. But the problem I have with Mandy, though I also like it quite a lot, I think Mandy runs out of gas because it goes, and then Nicolas Cage goes over here and does this. And then I actually think Linus Roach is a real problem in Mandy. And I think that what makes this movie work is that because, weirdly enough, there is less story there, or put it this way, I think the story is better spaced out in Beyond the Black Rainbow, so that when I am hypnotized enough and then something else happens and I'm like, oh, I'm so intrigued by that. And then some more hypnotic stuff happens. And eventually, you know, Elena, the Eva Allen character, you know, she is going to try to escape the Institute. Yeah, by the way, in the ads for the Institute, would anybody want to go to that Institute? It seems like, I don't want to criticize the filmmaker, but it seems like his ad-making skills are not compelling or convincing to make people want to join the Institute. By the way, I also love that both movies are set in 1983, just because they're just both set in 1983, which I really, really do admire. Yeah, I kind of love this, I have to say. It does, it has its weak passages. There are parts of it where you're like, okay, I've sort of seen this thing. Oh, we're cutting back to that pyramid glowing thing again. But I was hypnotized by it. I was And I think partly because I think that the vibe it's working on, like THX 1138 kind of thing that it's sort of doing, I just think visually the movie never stops. It never lets up. And that when, I guess, spoiler alert, when they go outside the Institute, the real world is actually really a fun juxtaposition from everything else that we have seen up to that point. The whole flashback to 1966, I think, is really well done. This even more than Mandy. I mean, Mandy's a big screen movie, obviously, but this, I immediately thought, when can I see this at midnight somewhere? Like, I want to see this at midnight somewhere. Because I do think, you know, this is very much a, you know, as our reboot requester said, this is a love it or hate it movie. And I was quite pleasantly surprised I was on the love it side, because I did, this is not usually my jam, but this movie was my jam. And I think it's partly because of Michael Rogers. I agree with you. I think he is menacing in a way that doesn't actually get old. I consistently was like, oh, he's found a new way to make me really uneasy. I think maybe Elena is not as interesting as a character. I think that's a problem in this movie. But I was just so, it's a weird comparison. But the kitchen, part of the problem with the kitchen is that in terms of the mechanics of how they start to like run the rackets and take over is actually not very clear or interesting or satisfying. In a weird way, like, the kind of explanation, I put that word in quotes, explanation of what's going on in this is actually more intriguing and satisfying in terms of, okay, so this is the deal, I guess, and this is kind of what's happening, I suppose, that I was sort of sucked into it from beginning to end. It was interesting to go back and then read the reviews, and people were just like, what the hell is this? This like sub-midnight movie crap. And it's, I think Mandy is probably the more accessible movie in a certain way. I mean, just having Nicolas Cage in it, I think Nicolas Cage tells you how to approach that movie. But it is funny that Elena, or I guess Eva Allen, is like Mandy in Mandy. Like, this filmmaker has a type. He likes, you know, pale-skinned, slightly, you know, zombie-fied, beautiful women with, like, long hair. Like, that's kind of, I was like, oh, this is the rough draft, especially for, like, how Mandy is conceived in that movie. So, it's a movie I think it's very hard to convince people. If they're not going to like this, I there's no way I can tell you why you should like it, because you either get on that vibe or you don't get on that vibe, and I was very much willing to get on that vibe.
Yeah, and listen, I get it. I'm not arguing. Like, I found it. I wish I was not watching it on my laptop at like 3 p.m. like I did. I think it's not the ideal way to do it. But if you're willing to, I will say it's the type of movie that when it was over, I was like, wow, I guess I'll just go pick up the kids like it's a normal day now. Like, it really is a definite kind of you get in the, it felt like we talk about the midnight movie. It definitely feels like a movie that you should be walking out to at like 2 o'clock in the morning while everyone's smoking outside and being like, what the hell was that thing? And I miss that, right? That's the experience as you get older, you don't really get to do as much anymore. And I mean, if you swim to film festivals, you get that opportunity. But it definitely felt like a movie. I'm glad this came out in, what, 2010? If this would have come out when I was in college, I would have not shut the fuck up about it. Like, I just wouldn't have shut up. And I feel like that is, now there's more remove. I have less, I'm glad you mentioned seeing it in the theater, because I have less patience or time to fully invest in I'm going to go see this where it's supposed to be seen. I can't see it that way, so I have to see it this way. So, but I did like Mandy more. Mandy gives, I would argue that the way the ultimate resolution of this is not quite as viscerally satisfying as it is in Mandy. I would say that, and maybe that's a crowd pleaser. It's so strange to be talking about Mandy as a crowd pleaser. Everyone I talked to that saw that movie on a recommendation, I felt like I've had to apologize for in one way, shape, or form. But nevertheless, that movie is more, it gives you the goods ultimately in a way. This movie, oh, it's a budget, or it can't quite entirely do it, it doesn't quite get there.
You're saying that and in case people haven't seen this movie, I don't want to spoil it, so I'll simply say, you're saying that a rock is not how you thought the whole thing was going to resolve itself in this movie.
That's correct. Yes. That's correct.
I agree. I think that is also, it's kind of like, oh, well, that's a thing. That's a way that is a
particularly thing. When we've actually just seen these two random metal stoner dudes just get vivisected in like kind of exciting ways.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, that, like we've been leaning up the whole guy. This guy's the ultimate insane villain. And then it's like,
I think that also, I think it's also depending on your own personal taste. I think I prefer whacked out psychedelic sci-fi a little more than whacked out psychedelic like monster stuff, because Mandy has more of that. I think that it's funny that this tends to be a little bit more on my wavelength. It's a little more sci-fi as opposed to fantasy horror, and I think that also may be a personal preference why I give the nod to Black Rainbow. Yes, when the ending of this movie came, I did go, oh, okay.
I guess we're done here.
And now, disperse from the theater immediately. Please, please. Though I did stay through the credits because it was so, I did enjoy the score so much. Yeah, I was very pleased to get the chance to. And the trick, if you are watching on a laptop, which I also did. By the way, this is free on Vudu. I don't know how you saw it, Will. You can actually watch this free on Vudu. That's how I watch this. The trick is just stick your face as close to the screen as humanly possible and put in your earbuds. That is what I did. I'm sure my corneas will suffer because of that.
But it was
only an hour and 45 minutes.
Play that clip when your head explodes in 11 years.
My favorite thing, by the way, is afterwards, I looked on the Wikipedia page to discover what the story was because I couldn't figure it out. There very rarely do you get a movie on Wikipedia that has its own chapter devoted to the term boomer criticism. If you go to the Wikipedia page, there's a little thing about him talking about how much he does not, how much Cosmatos is a disliker of baby boomers, which is also pretty fun. I don't think this is a one-trick pony movie. I'm not saying you're saying this, but I think this movie actually establishes that the guy has a tone and a style, and he does different things with it with Mandy. I do worry about how far he can go with this, and maybe he wants to make just midnight movies. He's not like aspiring to do more than that, but for two movies though, these are pretty fun. I've very much enjoyed being immersed in both of them.
All right, I'm down too. Those were fun. I want to see that. I kind of want to see Mandy again. I forget how awesome Bill Duke is in Mandy. Bill Duke is so awesome in Mandy.
He is very good. It's a small part, but yeah, he's
yeah, he's awesome in that, and he's awesome in High Flying Bird. He had a good year last year, or this year. I guess this is this year. All right, that is. Not Blind by the Light. That's next on my menu. So that is Beyond the Black Rainbow. That was fun. Excellent choice. All right. Next week, Grierson, we have two new movies. To remind everyone, we're going to be taping a day later next week. We'll be back up a little. So don't look for us on Sunday night. We'll mess up your routine. Sorry. That's my fault. I'm going away for the weekend and will not be able to either tape or see either one of the movies. So I have to make sure to give myself an extra day to see them, because otherwise you just happen to listen to Grierson all the time. And who wants that, right?
We should put a poll. Maybe we don't want to. I don't think either of us want to find out the results of that.
Yeah,
also, there's a quick throw in. By the time you hear this podcast at some point next week, we will have our massive, massive Julianne Moore rankings.
She's made more movies than we realized.
Yes. For Vulture, in connection to After the Wedding, we have ranked 61 of her films. And I'm going to say, I'm pretty pleased with how it turned out.
Yes.
I think it was very fun.
Tim loves Julianne Moore. I like Julianne Moore too, but Tim loves Julianne Moore. And so I pitched this project to Vulture almost just for Tim's benefit, because I know how much he loves Julianne Moore, and particularly the movie that he has number one on the list. But then you're like, okay, all right, awesome. They're going to do it. Oh my God, there's so many movies. And like just all those like early to mid 90s movies where she was just like the fifth supporting actor in. She's in Hand the Rocks, The Cradle. She's in The Fugitive. She's in Body of Evidence. Good Lord. Anyway, let's get to next week's movies, Greer. So next week, speaking of which, is a movie we probably have to update some rankings on, now that I'm thinking about, because we also did our Cate Blanchett rankings. We have the first new movie next week is Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Based off the Maria Simple bestseller, starring Kate Blanchett, Billy Crudup, Kristen Wiig, Judy Greer. Always a good sign. Judy Greer, kind of the Bill Camp, kind of my Bill Camp would be Judy Greer. Lawrence Fishburne, but perhaps most fascinatingly, it is co-written and directed by our old pal, Richard Linklater, a filmmaker that we both love quite a bit, to say the least. And we loved his last movie, but I'm always curious about Linklater because whenever he does something a little bit more mainstream like this, I actually get a little nervous.
Yes, and I have seen this, so I'm not going to say anything. I think it is fair to say that this does you. I think most people would be surprised. Oh, Richard Linklater directed this. It does not seem like a Richard Linklater film.
Well, at least it hasn't because I haven't seen it, but maybe it is. We'll see. So that is Where'd You Go, Bernadette. Our next new movie is Blinded by the Light. Blinded by the Light. That's a movie that I am typing details into my phone right now and waiting for them to come up because my internet is down.
I'm happy to take this if you would like.
Give the details.
I saw this
give
at Sundance. I reviewed it at Sundance for Screen International. It is a new film from the director of Bend It Like Beckham, and it's based on a true story about a... excuse me.
Yes.
I'm
not going to let you do the plot details if you're going to cough in the middle of it.
My apologies. I'm trying to remember if he is British Pakistani. I believe that's correct. A young man in the 1980s who sort of is directionless and is into music, but is introduced to the music of Bruce Springsteen. And Bruce Springsteen starts to take on a very special meaning for him. He really starts to relate to the music and the words of Bruce Springsteen, and the film is sort of a semi, emphasis on semi, musical in which Bruce Springsteen's songs are incorporated into the story itself.
All right. I have the details for our reboot movie, Grierson, so thanks for filling in there.
Right.
And we have one reboot movie this week. This should be the interesting one. It is 1987's The Lost Boys. The Lost Boys, directed by Joel Schumacher, our old friend Joel Schumacher, starring Corey Haim, Atlanta Hawks owner Jamie Gertz, Edward Herman, Jason Patrick.
What a homer you are. Listen to that.
Yeah, I know. Kiefer Sutherland, Corey Feldman, and of course, the great Diane Weiss. My favorite little factoid about this movie that's only come up in the last year, do you know, I don't know if you know what I'm referring to, this movie is, the filming of this movie is directly referred to in Us. They filmed The Lost Boys apparently right by where the carnival is in 1987 in Us.
That's
and so they actually,
right.
They actually right. refer to at one movie, the vampire movie or something that they're filming over there, they're referring to The Lost Boys. So I have not seen The Lost Boys in many a moon. This is not one of those movies I watched a ton of as a kid.
This is one of those movies I have never seen from beginning to end. I've seen every bit and piece of it, I feel like, on cable, but I've never strung it together in succession the way a normal film-going experience would be. So I am... wary but intrigued about the prospect. By the way, I did double check it. He is British Pakistani. I want to make sure I got that right for Blinded by the Light. I'm actually really curious about The Lost Boys because I feel like for people of our generation, this movie is beloved. That's fair to say. I think, you know, beloved maybe in quotes, but people seem to have a fondness from their youth of seeing this film.
I also like that this is the first, the Diane Weiss won Best Supporting Actress for Hannah and Her Sisters in 1986. Remember that, Grierson?
I do.
She made Purple, here are her five movies in a row. Sorry, six. 1984, Footloose. 1985, The Purple Rose of Cairo. 1986, Hannah and Her Sisters. 1987, Radio Days. 1987, September. And 1987, The Lost Boys. So she must have just been relieved. She's like, okay, I would like to do something with vampires. I have done a lot of very serious upper East and West Side comedies, drama comedies. Can I please just do a vampire movie?
She probably thinks I need to make some money for crying out loud.
I know. She's Woody Allen. Working for a scale for this idiot.
I mean, I got the Oscar and everything, but yeah.
This is how she cashed in. Thanks.
With Woody Allen's old costume designer, Joel Schumacher.
Joel Schumacher. All right, Grierson. Next week, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Blind by the Light, The Lost Boys. Again, we'll be like a day later, but don't worry, we'll still be there.
Yes.
Grierson, have a great week.
And we'll figure out where the question mark went at the end of Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
Oh, yeah, but there's still like a comma in there, right?
There's
like
there is a comma, but there's no question mark, and it's very, very weird and upsetting.
Maybe they're just afraid ticket takers will be like, why are you asking me? My name's not Bernadette.
But it's also not in the book, right? The novel doesn't have it.
I don't know.
This is the type of due diligence we'll do in preparation for next week's podcast.
Probably not. All right, Grierson, have a great week.
Bye.
Bye!
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works 'cause of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only works 'cause of us.